You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we'll gladly slide to pick 15 if we get to go to the team we wanted to all along. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, the hopeful romantic, and I've had a really fun last few days. I don't know about all of you, but I like paying attention to the NFL draft. I like seeing where all the players go to. Like, to me, it's crazy to see Trevor Lawrence and Travis Etienne from Clemson both go to Jacksonville in the first round. They're joining me here in Florida. That's fun. It's fun to see the Patriots get a first-round quarterback. That hasn't happened in since Drew Bledsoe. So since the 90s, that hasn't happened. I was going to do the number of years in my head, but that's math. I'm not that too good at math. And now there's light at the end of the tunnel that we won't have to pay attention to Cam Newton much longer. I know that's how spoiled we are as New England Patriots fans, that it's been 20 years of Brady and 1 year of a terrible quarterback, and I'm whining. But we got Mac Jones from Alabama. I'm higher on him than a lot of people. You know, people like to compare him to Brady because he has a lot of similar skill sets as far as anticipating and reading a defense, which to me is the most important part of being a quarterback. To me, what I learned from Brady is quarterback needs to be able to anticipate by reading a defense and also can't be bothered. And I don't mean like can't be bothered like, oh, I have to play quarterback. So we're not talking about Daria here. We're talking about like you have to be able to stand in the pocket and be confident that you can complete the pass no matter what is going on. You know, that's why Brady has been so clutch throughout his career. It's because no matter what the situation, he's just cool. He's calm and collected. Mac Jones seems to have those other two things. And I'm confident that everything else that he needs, he can develop that under Bill Belichick. And I think this is another reason I'm excited. This is a big moment for Bill Belichick. Because the common narrative has become that Brady made Belichick, where I think they made each other. And if Belichick can get excited about Mac Jones and do it again, and I don't mean he's going to turn him into, you know, six Super Bowls, but if he can win a couple Super Bowls with Mac Jones, that will do a lot for Bill Belichick's legacy. That's enough football talk, because I know all of you are football fans. So we'll get into a bunch of other stuff. There's been some interesting stuff that happened this week. One sort of political, but I don't want to take it in a political direction. We'll see. We'll talk about it, what happened in Texas this week, the controversy there. But before we do that, joining me this trip from Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, it's been a great week for me, too. I mean, it's been it's starting to warm up a little bit here. It was, you know, hanging around in the 50s last week, but this week it's been, you know, peaking into this high 60s, low 70s. So I've been having a lot of fun taking the dogs to the dog park and enjoying some of the riding my bike around the beach area a little bit, trying to get back into the summer vibe here in SoCal. I had some friends over last night. We watched some UFC and played Exploding Kittens. It's a game you can play on your phone, but there's an actual physical card game too. And it was a lot of fun to play the physical card game, with a bunch of friends. So, imagine that, Justin, socializing together in California.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that allowed? I mean, I guess Disneyland just reopened, so you guys can start socializing again.
Yeah. As long as we maintain 6 feet of distance, right?
Yeah, funny thing about the Disneyland thing is one of my friends works for Disney, right? He sells like group packages and stuff at Disneyland, and he was taking pictures like because he was at Disneyland earlier this week. And then last night, Christine was on Facebook and was like, hey, is he at Disney World? Disneyland has been open for like a few days, and there are already people who have been to both parks, Disneyland and Disney World. That's crazy to me.
That is crazy. That is crazy.
Also, we got a bunch of people listening right now, so I'll plug Discord again in a few minutes, but through Discord, you can listen to us recording live. And Lucid Fitzpatrick, Midsider Lucid, just left a comment that says the NFL has designed a great annual schedule from playoffs into free agency to draft to minicamps. Offseason is compelling and keeps NFL relevant year round. Yeah, and that's one of the things that's great is they figured out a way to market the league all year in a way that's not as obnoxious as the NBA. Although, did you see what happened with Aaron Rodgers, William?
No, I didn't see what was happening with Aaron Rodgers.
So right before the draft, it broke that Aaron Rodgers was demanding to be traded from the Green Bay Packers. And I bring that up because that's sort of like what the NBA has become, right? All these players are just like, yeah, I'm not playing for this team anymore, so you better send me somewhere else or I'm going to sit here and not play. And, you know, to be fair, they have so much money that they can do that, right? They don't need to survive. And if that starts happening in the NFL as well, I don't know how I'm going to feel about that. It's going to be interesting going forward. But all right, let's talk about some other stuff, William. Let's hit the music. Just like really suck, no, we just complain, and I hope that this line goes on. Cause I'm on a roll here, I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you'll throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. As always, if you would like to support the show, you can do so through Patreon or Locals. Patreon is per episode. Locals is per month. You can go to themidside.com/Patreon, themidside.com/locals, and give as little or as much as you want. We accept everything, including affirmations. So I had a few things this week, William, that I had a hard time, like, do I put it in the art section? Do I put it in the life section? So this first one, this could be considered in the art section, so nobody like get in the comments and get on Twitter and yell at me and be like, why did you make the podcast disorganized this week? It's just what I most wanted to talk about first because it's most important to me. Army of the Dead released a whole bunch of really cool, awesome posters. The posters really gave me Sucker Punch vibes. If you remember Sucker Punch back in the day, they had character posters for each of the girls, right? Sweet Pea, Baby Doll, Rocket, Amber, you know, all of them each had posters. Well, they had this too for all of the people in the zombie killing crew, I guess we'll call them. I forget what they're called. They might be called Lost Vengeance. That might be the crew. I don't remember what they're called. We'll obviously know the full name, complete name, once the movie comes out. But these posters are really cool. They kind of have the I made the joke previously that this movie has sort of like a David Ayer Suicide Squad look to it. You know, it's got the neon from Las Vegas mixed with sort of the grittiness of a zombie movie. So they're really cool in that way. But something I thought was really, really cool was there's a poster for the zombie sort of god, zombie leader. So the twist in this movie is that the zombies, I don't know if you guys can hear Echo right now. She's whining. Hold on. I'm going to let her outside the door, even though she's going to want to come back in 2 seconds. Sorry about that. So the twist on these zombies is that they sort of have a hierarchy where I think it's sort of like, remember that game back in the day? And this is speculation on my part. The game back in the day where like, if a certain person killed you, you were controlled by them. And then they were controlled by the person who killed them. So there's like a hierarchy. It was like a mob game online or something. And I think there was a zombie variant. It's sort of like that, where this main guy, Zeus, is in charge, right? And then under him are the alphas. And then under him are sort of the typical zombies, the Zack Snyder Dawn of the Dead zombies that are fast and can fight really well. Now, especially because there was Netflix, as we're recording this, on Sunday, Netflix released a teaser that shows the way even Zeus acts. They're not fully rational or anything. I want to be clear about that because there was a line here. And that's sort of why this poster is really exciting to me, William, because as we've talked about before, zombies are sort of the ultimate collectivist monster, right? Yeah. You get eaten, they kill you, and you lose your individuality. But when you start making zombies rational, or you give them some form of consciousness, there's a concern that the typical Hollywood approach, the typical modern culture approach would be to humanize them and humanize collectivism, right?
Yeah, didn't we see that in Oh, what's that Will Smith movie?
I Am Legend. That's one of the reasons that movie is like, there's so many great things about that movie, but the ending is
The ending is messed up. Yeah,
right. The ending is he's the legend because he's the one who's been hunting them, and he's the real monster. And we also saw that in George Romero's Land of the Dead, where it was the typical, oh, it's the zombie apocalypse and all the rich people are living in a tower and everyone else is subject to the zombies outside of it and they have to fight them, which is very much a California thing, right? Because the rich people live in the hills away from everyone else. But
they could just film that today at Venice Beach if they wanted to.
Well, exactly. And this is one of the things I said about living in LA, is they take their culture and they think that's what the entire country and entire world is like. So they make a movie and they're like, oh, look how brilliant this is. It's commenting on the world. No, that's commenting on your experience in the world.
I am still privileged in some way.
Daniel popping up out of nowhere. So it had that in it. And then it went a step further where one of the zombies became a leader, Big Daddy. And at the end of the movie, somebody was going to shoot him. Somebody was going to shoot him, and the lead character was like, no, he's just, don't do that. He's just looking for a place to go, just like we are. And I wanted to reply and be like, except he also wants to eat you.
Yeah.
Except the only way they can survive is by eating you. Right? I guess, that's sort of debatable. They might just survive anyway. That was in 28 Days Later where they rotted, right? We saw in 28 Days Later, 28 Months Later, that the zombies, when they didn't eat humans, eventually rotted. But the point is, regardless if they need to eat humans, that's what they do. So there's a difference between like, oh yeah, don't kill that deer. Like, that deer's not a threat to us, you know, unless, you know, you need to eat it for food, then it's okay to kill it. But you don't want to just go around like randomly killing deer for no good reason, right? Any experienced hunter knows you have to have a sort of threshold, or you have to have a sort of control, self-control. You can't just shoot every deer you see, right? That's not rational. It doesn't work that way. So it's just that ending in Land of the Dead is so terrible. So even though Snyder's rationality is well established, and I have a lot of trust in him, when I start hearing this premise, William, about zombies having a hierarchy and everything, do you understand why that would scare the shit out of me?
Yeah, I can definitely see that. I mean, we've seen it done wrong so many times. Well, I wouldn't even say wrong. We've seen it seen lots of stories lose their way with this by not really grasping that distinction. And
right.
So yeah, I can definitely understand you being nervous about that.
Right. So this poster, when I look at it, William, this poster calms all my fears. And this poster calms all my fears because Zeus, the zombie leader, is, you know, dead set in the center of this poster. Under his arm is the Statue of Liberty. Behind him is the Eiffel Tower. Of course, these are the Vegas icons, not the real ones. And above his head, it says the tagline. And all of these posters say taglines. And above his head, it says, "Don't lose your soul." I don't know how you could make a zombie poster that is more of a warning against collectivism than this poster, William. This poster, I'm going to tell you what I think, and then I want to hear what you think after that. I see this, and I see, oh, this is a collectivist leader. He wants to make you one of his group, and in order to make you one of his group, you have to lose your soul to do that. That's what I see when I look at this poster.
Yeah, it's definitely alluding to giving away something precious, right? Something precious, and whether it's explicitly individualism or not, I mean, I don't see how it could be anything else, right? Like, this is what we're talking about here. We're talking about your autonomy.
Right. And it, you know, all these posters have this motif of Vegas, right? Where you're betting on your soul, or you're betting on your life, right? You're gambling with your life. And that's sort of what Batista's crew is doing here. They're going into this zombie infested zone to get this money. To get this money and to make their lives better. So in a way, it's a metaphor for life. In a way, it's a metaphor for life in a collectivist society. And I really see this poster driving that home. Like, this person is the threat. And then you look at some of the imagery from the trailers, especially the trailer today. If you go and you check out the Netflix trailer that I said they tweeted out today. I don't know if it's also on their YouTube page or not. their YouTube channel. But if you look at it, there's an imagery, there's an image of they're in some sort of building, the zombie horde, and Zeus and Athena, his queen, are in the middle of the horde, and on either side of them, you know, the horde's there, there's a little space in them, and he's standing in the middle with his fist in the air. And even in this, right? Even in this poster, do you see his fist is in the air and what he's holding, William?
Yeah. Sorry, I clicked away. I clicked back to the other one. To the second one. I'm not sure what he's holding in. It's.
That's a gun. Know.
Is it? It
looks, yeah, that's a gun.
It's kind of pink.
Well, I mean, that's the color scheme, right? The whole poster is orange, pink, red, right?
The
purple.
Yeah.
Right. But he looks like a revolutionary. Right, like, and that's what you would see in like a Marxist revolutionary. Sorry, I was getting notifications. I wasn't sure if they were in the chat because I scrolled up even more. And then, so that really blew me away. Right, I couldn't even fixate on any of the other posters because I was just like, wow, this poster is amazing. Like, this is, William, this poster is so beautiful to me, and it's such a good point that if the movie follows through with this, to me, this is the kind of poster you own and put up in your house. Yeah. It's that's how amazing it is. But then also in the Discord, Midsider Cody has an amazing analysis of one of the other posters. One of the other ones is one of the people in the group, and above his head it says, "You can't kill Vegas." And he said the following: "It made me think of David Lynch describing Los Angeles as a real American sort of town where everyone is willing to risk it all, kind of like Vegas. Vegas being a real American sort of town, so rephrase, you can't kill what makes us great. I know Snyder lists Blue Velvet as a favorite movie of his, so I would not be surprised if he's making a conscious Lynch connection, although I could just be reading way too much into that." I think the conscious Lynch connection may not be intentional, but I think the Americanism of Vegas is intentional, and I think that's something we have to ask about this movie. William, is why was it set in Las Vegas? And in my most positive interpretation, I think Cody is correct. And I think it's a really good analysis. You know, I don't agree with David Lynch that LA is an American town, not anymore. Maybe back in the day when Lynch said that it was. You know, nowadays it's been changed. And I mean, maybe Snyder's even saying that with this. Like, look what happened to LA. Don't let this happen to Vegas, right? Vegas is predicated on freedom, right? Do what you want. Find your enjoyment, and you can risk as much or as little as you want when you are there. And even the imagery, like I said, I talked about that one image like inside a building. Well, what about the imagery of the Statue of Liberty being underneath Zeus in that poster? And likewise, there's imagery in the trailers of him standing on top of the Statue of Liberty. There's only two possible ways to interpret this. One, the way Cody said, or two, Snyder is taking a very hard left turn and going like Rian Johnson did with the casino planet in The Last Jedi. And yeah. I'm not going to be convinced that Snyder's doing that until he actually does that.
So you're saying have faith.
Ironically, yes, I'm saying have faith, right? I am playing the role of Batman right now.
Oh, okay.
I'm also sharing my excitement. I mean, does this make you more or less excited for the movie, William?
More excited. I'm just sad I won't be able to see it in theaters unless I drive to freaking Nevada or something.
Yeah, that hasn't. I'm still trying to figure that out. Of all places, we should have it here in theaters, but I still don't know what theaters it's showing in. Supposedly, it's showing in theaters. I don't know if it's just going to be like New York City at this point, although are you allowed in New York City? So I wish they would let us know where it's playing because I really want to see it in theaters as well. All right, the next thing I wanted to talk about is, this is the one that's sort of politically related, but I don't want to talk about it from a political standpoint because I don't care about the, you know, sort of like, how does this help the right or the left or blah, blah, blah. What I want to talk about is sort of like, I am unsure about what the morality of this is, William, because there's a line here between helping somebody live his or her own life and damaging a person's life. And with an issue like this, it's so hard to find out where that line is. So this past week, the Texas Senate approved a bill about transgender medical care, and they're setting sort of certain standards that's saying things can't be done until people are 18. I found a headline from the Austin American Statesman where the headline is "Divided Texas Senate Approves Bill Defining Transgender Medical Care as Child Abuse." Now, the medical care they're talking about is puberty blocking medication and surgery. And basically what they're saying here is, and if you're under 18, you can't get either of those, right? You can't take the hormone blockers. It's illegal to prescribe them, and it's illegal to give the surgery, because the reason they're giving here is that if you're under 18 legally, and we define that age as a culture, right? You're under 18, you cannot make that decision for yourself. And once you're 18, then you can. And I guess they're saying there are statistics that back it up that most people who go through this at such a young age regret having gone through it or have some sort of remorse about it. Now, here's a question I have for you, William. It's interesting they're trying to legislate this, because what is the morality of, and this sort of leads into the second story as well, when we're going to talk about, you know, performance-enhancing drugs. What is the morality of taking a substance or performing surgery to change the way your body is naturally? And here I'm defining natural as, you know, the way you're born without any external substances being put into it. Now, that's going to be a problem, because philosophically, if we get down to that level, food is an external substance, right? I would say that are not typically on average consumed. We'll say it that way. So it's not typical that people take puberty blocking hormones, right? That's not a typical thing. You have to go above and beyond to make that, to ingest that. So my question is, what's the morality of this? I legitimately don't have an answer for this. I legitimately don't have an answer, because I get that there are people, I recognize that it makes sense that logically there are people who have some sort of dysphoria psychologically, right? That they don't feel like the gender they supposedly are. Although I don't even know what that means, right? I don't walk around all day being like, I feel like a man, I feel like a woman, right? It's just, I feel certain things,
man,
and I just feel,
I feel like a woman.
Right, exactly. I'm not like Shania Twaining all day, right? But where is the line here? What is the morality of, is it right to give this medicine and to have this surgery for people under 18? And on the flip side, is it right to deny it? I don't know the answer here. The libertarian side of me wants to say, you can't stop technology, so you might as well just legalize it, right? That tends to be the stance I take on everything. But is that right to allow parents to potentially, I understand how it could be seen as abusive.
Yeah, I think so. I probably have some very controversial opinions on this, but
well, identifying as a woman, that means
identifying as a woman. Yeah, exactly. Giving the female perspective. So there's this Brian T. Anderson book, When Harry Became Sally, which talks about a lot of the issues around the current, like, sort of transgender mania. And what I mean by that is, and this is pretty well documented, I think Quillette's been covering it in the UK, and it's certainly in parts of the United States as well, of, for some reason, especially female folks transitioning to male, and doing what you were talking about, having the regret. And so, and eventually transitioning back. The issue here is there's not a lot of resources for parents, and they are kind of out of control. And what I mean by that is, if you go to one of these, if you're a parent and have a child that's possibly suffering from gender dysphoria, probably also slightly autistic, that tends to be a pattern that they talk about in this book, and tons of other
issues. Hold on, I'm gonna stop you. I have a question. That book says there's a link between gender dysphoria and being autistic.
That there's not a link. I would say that that when they look at across folks who suffer from gender dysphoria at this younger age group, because remember, there's different times when gender dysphoria can be can be onset or can come, right? Mm-hmm. And the teenage years is one of those times, right? People are struggling to figure out who they are and may have other psychological issues. And
well, I was going to say, isn't teenage years just dysphoria in general?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we all remember that, right? So like, this isn't controversial. Well, it shouldn't be controversial, but it is controversial. And the issue is when you go into some of these gender affirming protocols that, by the way, have no science to back them up. That's the crazy thing. It's just sort of a, like one of those escalators, right? And you're on automatic and it's just, you know, well, of course, we immediately push you on puberty blockers. We, start sending you to gender affirming therapy. You start dressing as the opposite sex, blah, blah, blah. You just start doing all these things. And the proof is, if you zoom out, the parents are bludgeoned with saying, if you don't do gender affirming therapy, then your child will commit suicide. The bad news is the suicide rate does not improve whether or not people complete the transition process or not. That's the sad part. That's what the data shows.
Right. And this is even a link to COVID, right? Where I didn't expect to go here, but hey, we're here. The culture is so fucked up that we're going to have all these unintended consequences, right? Which a lot of it's going to be psychological damage. A lot of it's going to be suicide.
Well, there's another unintended consequence that's super important. A lot of, especially, and they bring it up in this book, a lot of the results that would have happened before this whole transgender craze sort of phenomenon, whatever you want to call it, what would happen with a lot of these women would be, well, some of them would just, you know, go on to be sort of like your run-of-the-mill, you know, they would go through basically the equivalent of a tomboy stage, right? And then they would come out and they would just kind of develop normally, right? Others would become lesbian. And I think that's the reason why this sort of isn't topic interesting to me is what is more fashionable, what is more acceptable in today's society, being a female to male transgender person or being a lesbian? Right, which gets you more attention? And now I'm not saying transgender people seek attention. It's the other way around. If someone has some sort of other complicating mental issues, which we know is very common in folks suffering from gender dysphoria, this could create a vicious cycle, right? Where they're not dealing with underlying psychological issues, it's feeding into the gender dysphoria, which then progresses worse and worse and worse. And if the goal is this person's ultimate flourishing, just like you were saying, Justin, I'm all for, if this is what will help them flourish, then yeah, let's do it. So then you add the complicating factor of, okay, so parents are given all this misinformation. They're told, even in this article, they say the bullshit about puberty blockers have no permanent effects. That is just a blatant lie. I have a friend that I grew up with who had, I forgot what it's called, but it's where basically puberty wasn't starting on time for him. So they gave him basically the inverse of puberty blocking drugs, right? They gave him drugs to force puberty to start. Now, why would they do that? Because there's certain ages that your body is ready to do certain things. And if you don't do them at those times, it's gone. That time is gone. Think of things like bone growth and like muscle changes, you know, face structure changes, right? All these things, right? Like that happen, like they happen in a sequence and at a certain time. Delaying that. So if it's medically necessary, if someone happens to have the, I forgot what it's called, where the puberty wasn't starting and we have to give drugs for that, if you're going to give drugs and delay puberty, that's a permanent change, right? You are permanently changing your development. It's not reversible. That you would have to have a time machine to go back and reverse it.
Right. I mean, Lucid said it in the chat. Mental development doesn't stop until the 20s. So if you're making changes when that development's still going on, then it's basic science. Like, I don't even know how to say it. Like, you don't need to be. This is where I don't get the part that people are like, you're smart. This is not intelligence. if you put a foreign substance into a body that's changing what would be the normal pattern at a time when things are changing versus at a time when things are not normally changing, that's different and that's irreparable. It doesn't change. And William, I think the best thing about what you said is what caused this bill in Texas to happen in the first place. Is there such external pressure in the culture right now that it changes the way people would normally address this and normally make these decisions to the point that the right has become reactionary? And I think, I don't know if I want to say it's because of Trump or it's because of, you know, whatever, but we've seen it over the past 4 to 8 years that the right has become reactionary in this way, that they see something that I tend to agree with them that there's an issue here, right? They see something in the culture that they tend to believe that there's an issue, that I tend to agree with them that there's an issue, and their response is, oh, we need to make it illegal. Where my response is, William, how do we fix the culture so people take this more seriously and it doesn't automatically go to, oh, you need to cut up on your kid or you need to put substances into your body? That's my concern, and that's why I think that's the best point you made. How do we focus on how do we handle this calmly and collectively and with a long-term approach? And this is, that's really where I'm getting to in my life, is short-term, long-term.
And the sad part is I agree with you that this is a reactionary law, right? And it's unfortunate because there is a sense in which the motive here is to protect kids from having things done to them that that they may not have the ability to consent to, right?
Right.
And this is a real problem. Again, this could easily be misconstrued, right? I can already hear the Twitter mob coming after me on this. I'm not saying all transgender people suffer from mental disorders, right? That is not what I'm saying. But the data shows that many do.
You can push that
right?
heat to me. You can push that heat to me. There's a valid argument for that. I'm not saying the science is settled. I'm not saying I've come to my opinion on that, but I could understand that argument.
And so if you have someone who gender dysphoria is one of many psychological issues that they're dealing with, it's an easy, in our current culture, it's an easy trap to fall in to think, if I fix this, that fixes all of the other things. And we're not clear on how that web interconnects, right? And there are lots of, there is some data and lots of anecdotes about folks talking about when they worked on their depression or their social, the other psych, I'm not a psychologist, so whatever, the other psychological issues, the gender dysphoria changed. Right, it became less intense, right? And that makes sense, right? Yeah, that makes sense. But even saying these things is not allowed, right? When you're doing gender affirming therapy, the fact to even question, like, hey, is this, you know, this is a thing, and it, like, acknowledging these feelings are fine, like that part of the affirming is fine, but saying, okay, and now we'll just let you rewrite reality, is not necessarily the right path, right? It's like, hey, let's work on, you know, if a parent right now, the opposite of this is what would happen. We've seen it in that case in Texas, right? Someone saying like, hey, you know, my child has some psychological issues, including gender dysphoria. As part of their treatment, I don't want them to be treated as I think in this case was a boy being treated as a girl, as part of their, you know, as part of what this parent thinks is a way to deal with their entire psychological picture. And that was seen as transphobic, right? It's automatically transphobic because you're not affirming. And it's like, wait a minute. We already don't let children make these kinds of decisions, right? About lots of things. Why is it automatic that they're correct, right? There's no, it's just, as soon as you say, I'm presenting as a woman, like I do on the show every week, you have to just accept it. Right? And affirming. So Justin, affirming.
Well, that's something I don't understand overall, William, is this whole idea of needing to affirm. One of my students actually talked to me about this week, where this is just a straight guy, right? He's a pretty quiet guy. He's pretty nice. Like, I've never seen him raise his voice ever. He always talks pretty calm. And he was like, you know, somebody asked me what my pronouns were, and I didn't know what to say because, like, I'm just a boy. And I told him, I was like, you don't have to say. Like, the normal thing, most people are the typical pronouns, so you don't need to say it. And he said, yeah, but the person turned around and told me that I wasn't affirming them if I didn't have my own pronouns. And that's what I don't understand about all of this, William, is why do you need to be affirmed? And what I mean by that is, like, I get it, you feel like an outlier or whatever, but again, isn't that normal for being a teenager? Like, that's how I felt all the way through college, right? Like, I still feel like an outsider. That's what the midsider is, right? You're not in or you're out. Sometimes you feel in, sometimes you feel out, right? For a while, I felt in with the Snyder fandom. Now I feel like I'm out of it because they've all gone fucking insane. Like, that's what life is like accepting that there's no really in or out. You, like, have people you get along with and people you don't. It's not about group membership. Right, I think that's ultimately what the midside has become, is the midside is you're in some groups, you're not in other groups, you're your own person. But I don't understand this need for affirmation. And what I mean by this is, if I had a kid and he was 15, he's like, I'm a girl now. I'd be like, okay, how are you going to act different? Oh, well, I want to wear skirts. All right, well, if you want to wear a skirt, go ahead. If that's what you associate as with a girl, and I don't, or as being a girl, right? That's what I don't understand about all of this, like, transphobia, social justice, far left woke stuff, is they're breaking down gender stereotypes. But then when you're trans, it's because you're supposed to be one gender, but you feel like another. So you want to do things that are more stereotypical that gender. Isn't the more affirming thing to do, William? Isn't the healthier thing to do, say, don't think about these labels and concepts. Tell me how you want to act. Yeah. Right. Isn't acting towards a concept second-handed? Like, I don't wake up every day and be like, I want to be a man. Right.
Yeah. I don't look in the mirror and say, how do I be gay today?
Right. Just when the opportunity arises and you see an attractive man, you're like, oh, I want his dick in my mouth. Right. Like,
exactly. It's the behavior. Exactly. We joked right. about that. Like, how would you I don't get any credit, right? If I sit on an interview panel in any employer that I've ever had, I don't get any credit for being a diversity interviewer, right? Because I'm not flamboyant, right? I don't wear a yellow triangle, right? Indicating my gayness, right? It's not anything. I conduct a pretty professional interview. There's nothing that would tell you that I'm gay, right? So, you know, imagine a candidate.
I'm gonna stop you right there. I'm gonna stop you before we imagine the candidate. Wouldn't it be bad if that was relevant? Like, didn't we just like nearly murder Harvey Weinstein because that's essentially what he did? He brought sexuality into something that had no business being there. So wouldn't your sexuality be completely irrelevant, and wouldn't it even be bad for it to be in that situation?
I'm not gonna say it's ever happened, but imagine getting feedback from a candidate, right? Saying, well, my panel wasn't very diverse. Okay.
Because it wasn't gay enough.
So, yeah. You didn't realize you had, you know, you made judgments on the diversity of your panel based on, you know, physical characteristics that you saw during the interview process. Or even that you didn't even hear because it's over the phone, right?
Well, it's like my interview panel wasn't diverse enough. What do you mean? Well, I don't think there was any gay on the panel. What, did you want like somebody to say they wanted to suck your dick? Like, why does it matter? Like, yeah. Why do you care?
I don't know. But this is the bizarro. This is exactly the bizarro concept you're talking about, right? So
100%. It's just, that's the thing, like, affirm these kids by just saying, you know, do what makes sense to you. Do what you care about. Act as you care about it. And if other people have a problem with it, affirm that those are the people that have the problem, not you. And that will solve a lot of this.
Yeah.
It's just kids want to, maybe it's the breakdown in the American family, because kids want to be accepted by their family. That's where a lot of it comes from. And maybe it's just like the dad who's like, oh, man, my kid's wearing a skirt. Just pretend he's Scottish. If you have that much of a problem with it, just say, oh, it's not a skirt, it's a kilt. If it makes you feel better that the word is spelt differently, there's no R, there's four letters. If that makes you feel better, do it that way. All right. Let's move on to another story. Another story is actually relevant to another comment that the next story is relevant to another comment that Midsider Lucid left in the chat. He said that, on a side note, I take a multitude of supplement toward different goals to improve my life, i.e. productivity, performance, longevity. And that's what the next story is about. So this was sent to me on Instagram by Christine about this tech founder who was fired for taking LSD at work. I found an article in the New York Post. Co-founder of $2 billion startup says he was fired for taking LSD at work. Let me find that. There was a quote here. Anyway, I can't find the quote. But the basics of it is this. He was taking LSD as a way to enhance his mental performance.
Presumably microdosing,
called,
I would say.
Right. It was called microdosing, yeah. Right? That's what I was building towards. And it was called microdosing. Now, I want to be clear. You have your contract with the company, with your board. If you violate that contract, they can fire you for whatever reason they want, right? That's the side we're on with that. So I'm not talking about, again, this isn't the political angle doesn't as much interest me here. What interests me here is sort of what Midsider Lucid is saying, and this is relevant to, you know, performance-enhancing drugs in the NFL. Again, where is the line, William? Where is the line? Because to me, I'm just going to tell you my immediate sense of life reaction to this. I just go, what are you, a fucking idiot? Like, who's like, you know, I'm going to drop acid in order to perform better at my job. Like, but then when I bulked, I would drink two protein shakes a day.
Yeah.
So where is the line here? Because clearly there's a line. And, you know, to me, I would say, again, protein is like, that's a natural thing. But I'm finding ways to eat it extra, right? So where is the line between dropping LSD and taking steroids, you know, perform in a sports game, and what I'm saying?
Well, I did. I think, you know, again, politics aside, I think there's been a lot of interest in microdosing, and I have some friends that do this or have done it at various times and find it to be effective. I think we talk about it all the time when we've talked about alcohol culture, right, in America. Of how, you know, how does this integrating into your life? Is it escapism and you know, turning off the, you know, like escaping the terror that is your mind? Or is it a, you know, is it a pleasure that integrates with the rest of your life, right? And I think that's kind of like how I would look at it. I don't know that there's like hard and fast, like innumerable rules, but I think the principle here is, how does it integrate with your life, and is it leading to your flourishing? And and certainly if it's aiding in your creativity, and you know, this microdosing, you know, there's some science around it about, you know, the long-term effects and things like that, just like everything else, then I don't see, like, I don't have that knee-jerk reaction of like, well, what the hell are you doing? Now, there's a huge difference if it's not microdosing, right? If he's literally just like getting high and then going into the room, that's kind of not good, right? Doing a little, you know, I'm thinking about like the 80s and coke, you know, 70s and 80s and people coked out, you know, at board meetings and stuff like that, right? Like that, this is a thing that's happened and it's not good, right?
Right. What's that Christian Bale movie when I think of the 80s where he's a serial killer?
The Bret Easton Ellis.
I can't think of the name.
American Psycho.
American Psycho. Yeah, that's what I think of when you talk about that.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's kind of where I would draw the line. What do you think, Justin?
Look, I think from an intellectual standpoint, you're right, and it's like I said, it goes back to I don't know if people heard this before. I kind of said it quickly. What I'm really getting back to in life is just the ability to think long term. It seems so many people cut corners short term because they think it's going to help you know, in the long term, and they're not, they don't have long term thinking. And I really think, you know, that's where a lot of the problem with the idea of self-interest comes in, right? Rational self-interest is people assume it's all short term. And when I look at a drug like LSD, right, and even marijuana, right, you know, last week we talked about 420, last episode we talked about 420 and all of that stuff. I look at these drugs and I have the Adam Carolla approach to them, where it's like, we've seen what's worked over the history of humanity with these things, and then all of a sudden we think we're going to rewrite the way it works. Like, LSD, right? I don't know the difference between microdosing and getting high between semantic. I really don't, William, when I heard you say that. What is the difference? I don't see a difference. And we know the damage it does. We know the damage it does. So I'm with you with your intellectual argument. And, you know, I haven't read the full comment yet, but Midsider Lucid said enhance versus alter in the chat. And I think that's another way of saying what you're saying, William, enhance versus alter. And that's the whole short-term, long-term thing as well. And that goes back to the transgender discussion
I think to add one more layer of nuance onto the comment there, it's, I think in some cases, alter is even okay, but it's in service of the rest of how it integrates through your life. I can give you, like, there's people who do the, what's that shit you go in the tent and you throw up? And they have, but it actually works as a treatment for like PTSD, right?
Bulimia?
So in this case, it's not what?
Bulimia?
Ayahuasca, I think.
I was making a joke.
But you understand what I'm saying? Like in this case, it's like a treatment, right?
And
so like alter is okay sometimes too, but yeah, there's a huge difference. I think that line between like, are you just seeking this altered state just to seek the state, or is it? You know, is there a further, again, escaping reality, escaping your troubles, or are you trying to change something in your mind or body?
Right. No, 100%. And I think that that's sort of the similarity between this and all the transgender stuff we were just talking about, where it's the first reaction is never like, who am I and how do I optimize who I am? It's always going to an external place. You know, we see this. This is, you know, this microdosing. I don't think it's a coincidence that it's in the tech industry that this happened, this person. Because rather than saying, oh, how do I perform better? You know, how do I get more sleep? How do I eat better? How do I exercise better? Right? Or how do I take things? How do I put things in my body that, what does he say? Adding fuel that your body uses in a natural process to make that process better. Right? That's what Midsider Lucid said. How do you do that? Right. They don't think that. They just go, oh, what's something I can do that can get a trick around this, that I can, you know, do this quickly, that I can cut this corner. And I think that's where my problem is with something like microdosing is just, to me, it's just a fancy word for getting high because you don't want to, you know, what did Tom Brady do? Let's look at it that way. Let's use the Tom Brady example, right? Because inevitably we talk about Tom Brady and Zack Snyder in every episode. Didn't Tom Brady do what we're describing, William? Didn't Tom Brady do that
microdose?
With the TB12 method? No, he didn't. He did the opposite of microdose. He would go to sleep every day at 9 p.m. He would not eat strawberries because, you know, that he didn't want to be inflamed. Right? He doesn't drink beer. He mainly eats fish. Right? He did all of these things to optimize what he really had. He didn't say, oh, well, the best route to being the best football player is to take steroids and then be suspended for a season, and then every other season I'll be better than everyone else.
Yeah, I think there's probably more virtue to microdosing than what you're giving it credit for, and I certainly see the point that you're trying to make, though, that there's sort of hacking in a bad way, right? This biohacking in a bad way, meaning short-circuiting, trying to excuse destructive behavior by short-circuiting it in some other way.
Right, and I've created the binary of microdosing versus the TB12 method, because I think the TB12 method is biohacking. I think it's a method of biohacking. But that's sort of our, again, this is a general cultural thing, right? And this is what it always comes back to, and why we're less politically focused here in the mid-side, is it always comes back to the general culture. And there's a general culture right now of people of average intelligence and ability, And I'm not looking down on them. I'm looking down on the way people are acting, because I definitely consider myself an average person, right? To quote Batman vs. Superman, I'm just a guy trying to do the right thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am not a genius.
Exactly. Exactly. Myself. That was very smart myself, but don't get too smart. But that's the entire point, right? There. Look on Instagram. Look at our culture right now. There's everybody who thinks they can biohack, right? It's even like, I've even said this before, meal prepping. And this can sort of be our final thought here, William. The term meal prepping. I technically meal prep, right? So on the weekend,
so
I cook all... Well, exactly. I cook all my chicken for the week. Why do I do that? I do that so I don't have to every night come home after school and cook for the next day. It saves me time, which saves me stress, which makes it so I can perform better. People call that meal prepping, but isn't that just cooking ahead of time? But we create these new terms so we can seem like we've figured out life and how to be smarter than everyone else. And rather than using the collective human collection, I don't want to say collective because that gets confusing, the collection of human knowledge that existed before us, human knowledge and wisdom, we just invent new terms and post it on Instagram and act like we're quote unquote biohacking, microdosing. See what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll end there. I got a couple movies I want to talk about, and then of course we have Trailer Takedown, so let's hit the music. Put me into syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. As always, if you would like to continue the conversation during the week, you can do so by joining our Discord channel. As you're noticing this week, as we've mentioned several times, there's a bunch of people listening in on Discord. You can listen live in the episode and you can affect the episode. You know, you can affect it during the week by, you know, leaving comments, giving topic ideas. You know, we saw Midsider Cody had a great comment that we read on the episode this week. And you can also listen in live and leave comments and affect the discussion that way. So join our Discord channel. You can do so by going to midside.com and themidside.com/podcast and click on any episode link. And in there is the join Discord link. So before I head into my review this week, I want to talk about the other topic that I considered putting on Life on the Midside, but I ended up putting it on the art section because it's about one of my favorite movies ever. So recently, Edgar Wright remastered Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, and it was re-released in theaters into the Dolby theaters. Right? I don't know if everybody has these types of theaters, but at the AMC Disney Springs where I live, there's a theater that like it's different technology. I don't know the specifics of it, but I do know the chairs and the room like shakes a lot at certain points based upon the level of bass. I don't know if that's just how loud it is. My ears certainly don't hurt as much as after a concert, right? After I would go to Chain Reaction in Anaheim, my right ear would hurt. I'm pretty sure I have hearing damage from that. So it's certainly not that. And they show at the beginning, like a little video that shows the difference in the color. Like it's supposed to be deeper colors, like deeper blacks and things like that. So they released this movie in theaters and I took this as an opportunity to see it again. And Scott Pilgrim versus the World is one of my favorite movies ever. It to me is one of the best movies ever made. I tweeted after I saw it again, and I legitimately believe this, that it's a perfect movie. The one sort of small critique I would say this time that I noticed, and it's probably because I've seen the movie so many times, is that there were times I could tell when it was in the fight scenes when it was Michael Cera's stunt double rather than him, the person fighting rather than him, but it was almost imperceptible, and I was really, you know, being hyper vigilant in order to see that. So whether that's an error, whether that's a mistake, or that's a limitations of the technology, especially how old this movie is, I don't know. That's a discussion people can have on their own time. But for me, this movie succeeds on so many levels. It takes what I love, right? It takes a premise. It takes an idea that's important and it discusses it in a way that's non-realistic, but still maintains the realism of the ideas. And what I mean by this is about Scott Pilgrim trying to date and trying to be in a healthy relationship. But he has so many issues, you know, self-esteem issues. And the girl he's dating has so many self-esteem issues that it turns into a fight. And this fight is concretized by having him fight her seven evil exes. And throughout the movie, it's sort of video game style, which is the stylistic side of it, right? He fights each of the exes, and that's him coming to terms with her past and helping her deal with her past. Because it's only until she deals with it as well that they're at a point that they can just be with each other. But the beautiful thing about the movie, especially versus the book, is it's framed in a way that the entire movie is about Scott battling himself. I even noticed this time there are lines at the beginning where he's playing Dance Dance Revolution with a girl he's dating, and the Nega character comes on. And he's like, I can never beat this guy. And she says, don't beat yourself up over it. And I was like, wow, that's a really subtle, almost imperceptible line of dialogue that you'll miss if you don't get what's going on. Because the end of the movie, you think he's going to fight himself. He kills the last ex, and then Nega Scott comes out, which is, you know, the mirror dark version of him. And you think he's going to fight, but they end up just being friends. He's like, yeah, he's actually a really cool guy. And that seems just like a throwaway gag, but that's actually like a really cool statement there. He has come to terms with himself. He's accepted himself, especially because in the movie, the final sword he gets is the sword of self-respect. And he's like, no, I'm not fighting for this girl anymore. I'm fighting for myself. That's why I'm dealing with all this stuff. That's why I'm going through these struggles. Where in the book, right, because it's based on a series of graphic novels, the final sword he gets is the sword of understanding, where the point is, in order to be with someone, you have to understand who they are and what they've been through. Which, again, that's so, and I say again because I always say this on the show, that's so second-handed. It's so external. It's about how you treat other people that gets you what you deserve, not how you treat yourself. And so when you talk about stylization, you talk about execution, you talk about writing, everything about this movie, William, to me is, I was laughing hysterically the whole time. Like, it's just, it's one of the best movies ever made. And when I talk about my writing, my rating scale of, you know, just no bro, bromantic, and so bromantic, this is the epitome of what a so bromantic movie is. Have you seen it, William?
It's been a while. I should definitely put it back on my queue to rewatch it. It'd be nice if the Dolby version comes out on digital. I know that they might be releasing Blu-ray.
Yeah, or I don't know, maybe they'll do 4K. That's the new thing they're doing with movies, is they're releasing 4K movies. So,
yeah.
Are you a fan of the movie?
I am. I remember liking it a lot. It's been years since I've seen it. And it really gets back to that that style, the sort of absurd style, but then treating the people as real people that I really like.
Right.
That's something that I could totally get behind. I mean, this is in stark contrast to, you know, we talk about it all the time, but the more naturalistic storytelling where it's like the events just happen and happen and happen. Right. And in these, in this movie, you know, if you're watching for the first time, you don't really know what's going to happen, as in like how it's going to be represented. Right. But the character and the character development makes sense.
Right. And I think what you said is sort of, I would say that that's at the core of what makes Snyder movies so good, is they're absurd situations, but it treats the psychologies and the choices and the conflicts and internal struggles of the characters as real. Speaking of which, I'd like to review a movie this week that sort of I saw a lot of people talking about. I was even getting text messages about it. And I think it's one we talked about as a trailer on the show before, William, and it had a different name. Have you heard of the movie The Mitchells versus the Machines on Netflix, William?
No, I haven't.
Okay. There was a trailer we watched a while ago. It's an animated movie, and it's this girl is going off to college, and her dad in order to try and reconnect with her and make her closer to the family goes on a road trip to bring her to her college because she's going to film school in California, which of course, but we'll get into that in a second. I believe this went under a different name, and when I looked it up, it was went under the name Connected. Does that sound familiar to you at all?
No, I don't even remember that.
Okay. Well, I thought we did. Maybe it was a while ago. This is one of those that got pushed back due to the pandemic and everything, and then Netflix ended up buying the distribution rights. So this isn't by, like, DreamWorks. This isn't by Disney. This isn't by Pixar. So this is an animated movie by, like, a non-animated studio. Not that they don't do animated movies, but, you know, this is by Sony. They're not considered, like, the front runner in the industry, right? So it's good to see a non-front runner company making a movie like this, because it's bringing other people into the marketplace, which can only benefit, right? If they can improve and they can make good movies too, it'll push everyone, right? Pixar is doing so well that things like this happen. So I've already told you the basic premise. At its core, this movie is about the relationship between a dad and his daughter. And I will say that at its core, that relationship is, it emotionally resonates. And it was very moving. Although I have a slight problem with the way it was done, and I'll get to that in a second. Because first of all, I want to say what the rest of the premise is. They go on this road trip where she wants to go to film school and she wants to connect with her people, as she says. She's going to go to film school to finally find her people. And her family wants her to, you know, connect with them again. But as they go, the AI apocalypse happens. So the Mark Zuckerberg character in the movie releases new personal assistant robots that are run by AI, which are basically Siri, except he throws his phone out. He's like, "You're obsolete." And when he throws that phone out, the phone takes over and leads all the AI robots to take over the world and put all the humans into little pods, sort of like in WALL-E. Because remember WALL-E when they were in the spaceship and they were all in their little sort of like pods? It's sort of like that.
They're fat pods. Yeah,
similar, except they're not fat yet. Although it insinuates like, oh, we're going to give you guys free Wi-Fi and you'll be fine. You'll just be floating in space. And they're going to shoot them all into space on rocket ships. Except the only people they don't capture is this family, right? Is the Mitchells. So the whole movie is about, predictably, the Mitchells bonding together and using their really weird quirkiness, because one of the subplots of the movie is these are like not your average family. They're like, I don't know, I guess you could say it's sort of like Family Guy and Simpsons, where like they're really like, I don't want to say stupid because they're not particularly dumb, but they don't act like in a way that's normal or accepted. They're very weird. They're very quirky. And the mother is aware of that, and she's jealous of the neighbors who, in a nice bit of casting, are played by Chrissy Teigen and John Legend, who are very popular on social media and present themselves as the perfect family, right? Like, to the point that they're all trapped together when the robots come, and that family has like a martial arts routine, a defense routine planned out already. They're like, "We prepared for this scenario," and they try and fight, but they still get captured. But the Mitchells are the ones who survive. So there's a whole element of that in here as well. So they bond over it at the end. You know, they're able to defeat the AI.
There's walkers in the barn and Lori's pregnant.
Yeah, I mean, come on. If you're worried about it being spoiled, it's not about the what, it's the how. I will look. Any story is not about the what, it's the why the story is told and the how the story is told. And there is still value in watching this movie after everything I've said. You know, they get to the end and, you know, she's obviously like, oh, my family is my people, not the people I'm going towards, blah, blah, blah. So, like I said, at its core, it really is the dad-daughter relationship. Now, the good thing that is worth watching it about is this is a hysterical movie. The animation style, the editing style is clearly done in a way to appeal to the YouTube generation. It's computer animated and then they draw over it at times. I really, really liked that. I really, really liked when they drew over it at times, and the style of animation, it worked really well. The humor, I was laughing hysterically at a lot of the things that happened. There's even a Dawn of the Dead reference in here because they go to a mall at one point. So there's a lot of really good stuff in this movie. The thing that is keeping me from rating this too highly is a couple things. One, the ultimate payoff to the plot line about the whole tech thing is the Mark Zuckerberg character says, it's almost like stealing people's data and uploading it to an unregulated tech monopoly was a bad thing. Now, I like that, but the use of the word unregulated assumes that government was the answer here. Right? When they had this wonderful way of, and that's why I talked about the original title, they could have called this Disconnected, because the movie was really about how the entire family was disconnected because they're always on their devices and the dad didn't know how to use technology and he had to make no lack of screen time. So they could have made a wonderful parable about knowing how to use the technology to properly connect with each other rather than over relying on it to the point that the AI can take over the world. But instead, that was the payoff for that one, for that plot line, for that subplot, which feeds into my main problem with the movie is you can so tell this is written from the perspective of somebody who, you know, the typical LA person. Oh, well, I'm ostracized from my family, so I'm going to write about how it's the dad's problem and the dad had to accept her. Right. It made it so the problem was, oh, the dad has to realize that his daughter is a separate person and that he has to accept that she's a separate person and has her own interests, which is true. A lot of parents struggle with that. But at the same time, the daughter is a complete bitch to the dad. And you need to learn as an adult and as you grow up as a young adult that just because somebody treats you in a way that may not be rational, it doesn't make it okay to be a bitch to them. And I kind of feel like that's one of the biggest problems that art has taught in our culture, that this Hollywood culture, you know, this naturalistic culture where everyone's a victim, you know, the social justice culture has put into our society is this idea that, oh, well, if people treat you like shit because they have problems, the best way to handle it is always to be a complete asshole to them. And I agree, if someone's punching you in the face, you have a right to self-defense. But sometimes the best thing to do when someone's a dick is just like ignore them and be like, okay, you're an idiot and move on with your life. You know, I'm not advocating ignore the bully, but you understand what I'm saying, William, that like every time someone's like irrational and every time someone's a jerk and every time someone does something that you don't like, you can't like hold it against them for life and create this whole mentality of, oh, once I find my people, I'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that, you know, we talk about interpersonal hostility, right? It's sort of the inverse of that, yes. Right? Like, I don't assume just because, you know, you're not treating me perfectly, therefore I can treat you completely negatively, right? Like that leads to the interpersonal hostility that we've railed so much against.
Well, and I would even say, I mean, you said it's the inverse. I would say it's just another version of the interpersonal hostility. So thank you for bringing that term back. And, you know, that goes into the driving thing we always talk about and everything, where people drive aggressively and they always have to get ahead of people on the road and they can't wait for 2 seconds because it's always, I got to get ahead of everyone else, interpersonal hostility. So, yeah, I think that would sum up sort of my other issue with it is the interpersonal hostility the daughter exhibits is never really addressed. You know, they have a little bit of it where she, you know, says something that she shouldn't have said and she realizes it and she feels bad. But it's never like she has to apologize in the same way the dad does. The dad apologizes and then she's like, oh, OK, you know what? I actually do love you, too. So she never sort of takes responsibility. And I get it. I get it that it's a kid's movie. I get that it's a kid's movie. So it's on the kid's side. But I think one of the things that Pixar does well, William, and I want to see what you think of this, is I think Pixar makes movies that are balanced in the sense that it may be for kids, but it's not treating kids as if they can't grow up and be good people too. Whereas this movie is sort of like, oh, well, yeah, we're on the kid's side. We're going to show why the kid's right and the adult is the jerk.
Yeah, I think that's the difference between that's a great point, because the whole idea that made something like Toy Story so popular was that it expanded the audience to the entire family, right? Like there are plenty of, you know, quote unquote cartoon movies that were just plotted for a child audience. And that is that that was, you know, more than anything, that story revolution, that was one of the main drivers of that story revolution that Pixar brought.
Right, because the Disney movies in the 90s, right, the Renaissance, as they say it, that has stuff, those have ideas and ideals that can stay with you through life, right? That's why they're enduring, right? When you look at Aladdin, The Little Mermaid, The Lion King, that stuff can endure. But Pixar endures because you can keep rewatching it as you get older. Toy Story is a great example, and it doesn't feel old. Like, to me, the fact that the first Toy Story came out in the 90s is insane because it does not feel old. It ages with you because you see all the different perspectives. And I think that's why a moment like the end of Toy Story 3 is so powerful. When Andy passes his toys on to a new girl, to Bonnie, because you see his journey and you're able to understand how he sees it from a different perspective now. And that's in all those movies. So I think that's a story evolution is a really great point. So ultimately then, William, I would give this movie a nice middle ground bro. There's a lot of great stuff about this movie, but the storytelling doesn't sort of live up to the animation and the humor that's going on here. And the concepts. The concept of this movie is great. And I don't think the movie, the writing did service to the concept and the style, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But it's still worth watching, and that's something to keep in mind in today's society where everything's like, this is the worst movie ever. This is the best movie ever, right? Is this Scott Pilgrim versus the World? No, it's not. It's not the Shawshank Redemption. And I'm not going to pretend it is, but it's still worth watching. You will have a good time, and there are worse movies if you have a family that you could put on and be like, oh, let's watch this over and over again. It's not going to like rot the kids' brains, and it's not going to annoy you to hell. Like, I would say putting on Frozen over and over again would be doing your kids a disservice if you put on Frozen or Frozen 2 over and over again. But putting on this one, that would be fine. And you're not going to get annoyed at it either. Okay, so now that we've talked about movies that already came out, let's talk about movies that are going to come out in Trailer Takedown. I post the links now in our Discord channel. So every Saturday you can go in there and then you can watch the trailers that are going to come out. You can do it before the episode. You can do it after the episode, or you can alternate. You can watch a trailer, pause the episode, watch a trailer, pause the episode, so you're on the same page as us.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Ape vs. Monster is Asylum known for the Sharknado series. It's their version of Godzilla vs. Kong. And I'm going to take a interesting stance here. And it, you know, it was actually said in the Discord by Midsider Alex. I kind of think this looks better than Kong versus Godzilla did. Godzilla versus Kong did. It doesn't take itself too seriously. It kind of had that treating the characters with love thing that you're talking about, William, right? Like, the human characters felt like I'm supposed to like these people. Whereas in Godzilla versus Kong, they were all sort of annoying and they all had problems and things like that. Or they either that or they were all fighting the power, right? There was a likability here about this. And it wasn't like they were trying to pretend this was something other than it was. They were like, here's a giant ape fighting a giant lizard. And they got some ooze on them, and that's why they got big. So do I know if I'm ever actually going to see this? No, I have no idea, because I'm not going to go out of my way to watch this. But I'm not going to give this a bad rating, because like, if I was looking for something to watch on Netflix and like I'm on vacation and I just want to relax my brain, I think this could be some fun. So I'm going to give this a Netflix and hug.
Netflix and hug.
I don't think that's very controversial. I was thinking the same thing. This looks like a little bit of, Secret of the Ooze plus Godzilla. I don't think we're going to see anything groundbreakingly new, but I agree with you. This... The way the characters are at least presented in the preview is, it looks like these are supposed to be fun characters. Now, it could go all Sharknado and, just be ridiculous, and then it probably wouldn't interest me. But yeah, this is definitely one that they did a good job with the trailer. Like, this looks like it would be a fun popcorn flick, something to have on, like you said, something to have on. When you have some friends over, or when it's a hot summer night and you want to chill out somewhere and cool off. This looks like that kind of movie. It reminds me of some of the, it looks like a better quality version of a lot of the sort of the B monster movies that we used to get. And maybe there's a little nostalgia mixed in there too. I don't know, but I'm going to give it a Netflix and a hug as well.
Netflix and hug. Second trailer.
Sweet Tooth is a fantasy series about a world where there are hybrid creatures born and at the same time a virus comes. That's all I really got from the trailer. There seems to be a little of correlation and causation. You know, are these events correlated? Did one cause the other? That seems to be the conflict of the world. Of course, it later goes into in the trailer as, you know, the first hybrid baby that's born. It's like, oh, just because the world doesn't accept you, blah, blah, blah. Right. And again, as we talked about earlier in the episode, that's sort of like a normal teen feeling. But this plot line could very well, very easily go askew and be all about victimhood and everything. Right. I mean, that's the danger with this type of story. So I think this trailer looks like it was done very well from a technical standpoint. And the virus element is interesting to me. So I'm not going to give this a bad rating because this is one of those that if the hype exceeds it and what content I hear in the hype interests me enough, sort of like with the show Invincible. I haven't watched that. I wasn't interested in watching it, but I've been seeing a lot of conversation about it that makes me interested enough in engaging with it. So I'm going to get to it at some point. I will potentially watch this. So based upon the fact that it's on Netflix, I'm going to be nice to it and give it a Netflix and hug.
Netflix and hug.
Yeah, I was very much sitting on the fence on this one. Without really knowing where the theme of this is going, I don't think this would interest me very much. The reason I say that is, there is some, looks like there's some father-son stuff that might be interesting. It looks like there's, you know, like you were saying, the virus aspect, the sort of like this hybrid baby situation sounds like an interesting premise to explore. But I'm not sure if this is just going to be some sort of allegory for coming out or something, right? Like it could easily just go in that direction and just not right. be interesting. So I'm going to give it a very, very light tackle.
Third trailer.
Blue Miracle is a Netflix movie about a... I'm struggling because I'm confused as to what this is about. It seemed like two different movies. So it seems like an orphanage for young men. And there's a giant storm and then they enter into a fishing competition. Like I said, the first half like seemed like, oh, this is going to be a supernatural movie about like... Why did this fishing house survive, or this orphanage survive the hurricane when no one else did? And then the second half of the trailer was like, here's Kevin Costner, and he wants these boys to help him win a fishing competition. And they feel like they're destined to help him. That's like what gives their life meaning, which is sort of troubling as well. Like, you're going to convince these kids that what happened to them was so they could have meaning in their life, and the meaning was to win a fishing competition? I don't know. This whole thing seemed very bizarre. What I did like was stylistically, it stuck to the idea of blue, right? That was a huge part of the production design. I did like that. But one stylistic element is not enough to make me want to watch something. Tackle.
I thought that the first movie... Or sorry, I too thought it was two movies. I thought the first movie felt like a cool... like sort of kid suspense movie, and then the Agreed. Second movie just seemed like a Disney special, right? A Disney Agreed. Disney TV special. I don't know what this is. This can't be good. I'm gonna tackle it.
Final trailer.
Luca is Pixar's latest movie. It's going to be released only on Disney Plus, I believe, based upon the trailer description. It's about some like mer monsters who, when they emerge from the water, they become like people and they live off of a little village in Italy. And it's their interaction with the world in that village in Italy.
There was a fish out of water story.
It is a fish out of water story, actually. And that's the thing I was going to say, right? So there was a trailer, a teaser a while ago that it showed that, right? The first half was like, oh man, Teen Angst, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, this is uninteresting. And then it showed them jump back into the water and they became the mer creatures. And I was like, okay, this became more interesting. Well, this is the opposite. The trailer starts with them coming out and shows everything else. Because of the style of animation and because it's Pixar and because there's a warmth to this, there is a lot of goodwill built up for me. But it could, and this is sort of a theme in this episode, I think, and a theme in these trailer takedowns, it could go the boring and trite way, William, that you just said. It could go the boring and trite way of like, oh, we're the underdogs and we need to rebel against the world. I Pixar has done enough for me that I'm looking forward to this, and I have hope for it, although I'm a bit cautious. I'm still going to hug this.
Hug?
I think that I agree with everything you said, and the one thing that struck me is that there's two male characters as kind of the lead, which is kind of rare, right? We've had everyone cashing in on the Frozen thing. So could this present some healthy, you know, sort of boy psychological growth? Maybe? I mean, that's the hope. Can I hope? Is that allowed? Hug.
Hug!
All right, that brings us to the end of this episode. What did we learn this trip, William?
I learned that the Oscars were so boring that we didn't even bring it up. Justin, what'd you learn this trip?
That's funny. I didn't even think of the Oscars. I don't know. Just reinforce some things, reinforce some mid-side concepts here, right? You know, we talked about previously, we had like Coward or Crusader, which is a big one. I think now today's day and age, I think bringing back the idea of interpersonal hostility is very important. I think that's something we should continue to think about. And I also think it's important to continue to think about short-term versus long-term when thinking about life and thinking about the value of the individual and self-interest. So I think those sort of three things are, you know, you forced me to reflect back on Coward or Crusader. You asked me to reconsider interpersonal hostility, which I really appreciate you doing that. And you made me think of short-term versus long-term. So I'm going to keep all those things in mind going forward. And if you're going to keep all those things in mind going forward, we appreciate it, just as we appreciate you listening to the podcast. Without you, this is just me talking into a microphone, ranting and sounding like a lunatic as I'm sitting in a closet, right? I'm just a crazy guy. Thank you to our Liberty.me listeners. We always appreciate the libertarians. Something I was reflecting on this week is I retweeted a tweet from Glenn Jacobs, formerly Kane, who's a mayor in Tennessee. It was about libertarianism, and I thought what he said was a very rational and best possible version of libertarianism. And, you know, last week we sort of were critiquing it because of, you know, the whole 420 drug association hippies of the right thing. And I think it's important to look at libertarianism from that positive perspective. And I think most people, when they're rational, when they're well-adjusted, and when they truly understand the spirit of America, I think they're more towards that live and let live, don't want to bother people perspective of libertarianism than they are the sort of hippies of the right version of libertarianism. If you want to support us, you can always do so through Patreon or Locals, themidside.com/Patreon, themidside.com/Locals. Go to themidside.com/store and get a t-shirt or laptop case or something of that nature. Or you can buy mine based on a true story novel, The Cut, at themidside.com/The Cut. All of that is how we keep this show going. It's how we keep the lights on. It helps us have a better life, so we appreciate that. And as always, the best thing you can do is you can tell a friend. I love the number of people listening in Discord this week. I want to get the conversation growing louder. We're going to try and do some other things to up engagement. We're going to try and do some live streams on YouTube and see how that goes. So just tell a friend. Tell them how great the Midside is. Tell them how there are other rational, reasonable people out there who want to talk to you and with you. This concludes your journey into the midside. I'm Justin Eblesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a blue day. You know, I think it'll be funny that we'll be streaming on YouTube consistently before the Oscars are ever going to stream on YouTube.
I mean, that's the way everything's been happening for the past 10 years in America, hasn't it?
I don't know if you saw, but part of the explanation for the low ratings is the absolute mad hurdles you have to go through to watch it online.
Okay.